So I want to say one thing to you people today, okay? It's about love and it's about the power of love.
Yeah.
What did we think?
Actually, you know, yes, it did go on, okay, and he repeated. But actually, I enjoyed that bit, I have to say.
So we're talking about the royal wedding?
Yeah.
Where were you, Camilla? Let's get, where were you? Where did you see it? Where did you watch it?
I saw the whole thing.
Yeah.
I sat with my cup of coffee and I applauded when she walked up the aisle by herself. Now, the whole thing with Prince Charles was kind of neat and sweet, and it did look like he was welcoming her. But really, I was wanting her to walk up by herself.
And as a person of North American origin, did it make you feel proud?
I was rooting for the Canadian. I mean, in my book, in my book, she's a Canuck because she worked there for 7 years. I used to live in Toronto.
Yeah.
I'm sure that everybody's taken her to their hearts, the power of love. But, you know, the Canadians, we need to brag more. We're very modest people.
Bringing it back to us, right?
Yeah.
Good charity, bad charity, we're here again. There's something about that royal wedding as an event which has done a huge amount for an awful lot of charities, because all of those people representing charities who were there, you know, it was very, very obvious that this is almost a statement of intent, isn't it? These were not people from the city traders. These were not people from wealthy background or landed background. These were people who are digging hard into the charity sector and working very hard.
Yeah. And it wasn't just the good and the great. And that was good. And that was good. And I love the guy because, A, he's natural. And he follows his mum's views,
yeah,
which I think has been missing for some time.
Yeah.
And he's out there with it.
I hope she can keep it up, because I think she'd be a great human rights campaigner within the royal family. She has a very calm presence. She does appear to be listening. She interacts. She reacts out there. There are a gazillion people writing to her. And I'd be writing to her and saying, wouldn't you like to be on this podcast?
I think that's a great idea.
Right. How do you spell her name again? Meghan...
Remarkable Markle is how I think
of her.
Yeah.
But she had that constant smile on her face for the whole of the 14 and a half minutes the preacher was talking.
So is it a moment then for the charity sector in Britain? You were looking a little bit concerned about that.
Yeah, it depends on how they deliver. And I think we're going to be talking about that a lot, probably in every single podcast we do. Can you engage everybody, give everybody hope, and then deliver? Because if you can't, you're letting everybody down massively.
Yeah, and I think it's an open door now. I think she's opened, or they've opened the door. I think the two boys have opened the door more than anybody else. They seem interested enough to say, we'll go to those places that the royals never used to go.
Shall we introduce ourselves?
Yeah.
This is Good Charity, Bad Charity.
I'm Keith Davis.
Hi, I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm David Press. We've got a really exciting edition today because our guest is a guy, actually, who I've known for quite some time, almost 20 years. He is an extraordinary individual who has worked in the charity sector for 22 years in very senior positions, running small charities, running a very large charity, and currently running a charity which is doing one very focused, single-minded approach. His name is James Whiting. He's the Executive Director of Malaria No More UK. We're all very excited to meet him because he's clearly a figure who has created a huge impact.
There is a great story there.
Yeah.
There's a great story there. A couple of questions I've got about how and on the way and the what, the why and the where.
Yeah, keep your powder dry.
I will try.
Camilla?
Yeah. Dynamic. That just leaps out of everything that he does. I wonder if he looks behind him. Does he see who he's dragging with him? Or is he out there on his own being dynamic and everybody's in the background going, oh God, what are we going to do now? What are we being dragged into?
Okay, let's get him in. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. James, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for coming in and for facing us all in such a kind of open and friendly way. I want to start off with your World Cup winning moment. I know this because I met you a couple of months ago and you were preparing for an extraordinary event which you told me you'd spent about 2 years mulling on and thinking about. You organised an event to draw attention to the fight against malaria in London, around the Commonwealth Summit. You had heads of state signed up to the campaign. You had David Beckham, you had Richard Curtis, you had films, you had publicity, you had coverage in all the newspapers. At the end of that session, you had got pledged $4.5 billion worldwide. That's winning the World Cup, isn't it? How did you feel at the back of the room?
Thank you, Dave. That's quite a build-up. I obviously, you know, you can't really fail to feel pretty good when something that you just talked about with one or two people about 2.5 years before turns into that. And there were so many times along the way when really very powerful people in one way or another told us that it wasn't going to happen or wasn't going to be possible. But this is going to, I mean, I think I'm frequently going to sound very arrogant. I didn't feel like I'd won the World Cup. I felt like we have won perhaps, you know, maybe just the European Cup. Actually, the World Cup is a long way out there. You know, the malaria campaign needs about $5 billion a year in order to end malaria, hopefully, in the next few decades, which is really possible. And so this, to be honest, was just a start. But it was a good start.
Malaria No More's aims and its objectives and how it spends its money, or is it spending money? Just explain to me a little bit the overview of the organisation.
Our aims are to do whatever we can to accelerate the end of malaria. But perhaps it's a bit more than whatever we can, because we thought really hard about what could a small organisation bring to the malaria campaign. And the answer is not distributing bed nets or treatment or whatever, because that's done rightly by organisations that are really big. But the biggest risk that we kept hearing that people were talking about was the funding for the malaria campaign. Simple reason is that malaria affects children and pregnant women in the world's poorest rural areas. And so we unashamedly are an organisation that is, if you like, a voice for people that is trying to make sure that the voices of those folks that are being affected by malaria are reaching the powerful.
What seems interesting to me, I mean, you know, I've read stories over the last 10 years or so about the possibility of eradicating malaria. People saying, well, look, we can shoot them out of the sky with lasers. We can... No, it's about bed nets. No, it's about education. No, it's about biotech. It just seems to me that there are so many different kind of plans almost.
Point one, it's complicated. This is a disease that has killed nearly half of all humanity that have ever lived.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
So the idea that we're going to solve it with one or two things is just, you know, obviously for the birds. Having said that, bed nets, treatment and testing are phenomenally cheap interventions, and they save, just those three interventions are saving millions and millions of lives. And just using those three interventions, together with reasonable health systems, we can get deaths from malaria down to very close to zero.
Can I just come in there? Because I love your aims. Malaria No More UK's aim is to end suffering and deaths. Hell of an aspirational aim. But there is, in this vertical funding problem with charities, that you talked about the cause, which is that, you know. You talked then about prevention, which is the bed nets and all the rest of it. But how then, within this $4 billion that you've got, do you address the cure? Because whilst the protection is temporary, the real stoppage has got to be the cure.
Simple answer, Keith, is that actually malaria has been eliminated in about 90 countries in the last 50 to 100 years. So right. With what we have now, you can actually eliminate malaria as you go forward in most countries. The challenge will be in the really, really super high prevalence areas in central tropical parts of Africa. That might require a vaccine. It might even require gene drive technology. What it will require is good health systems. So what you mentioned, vertical, I think it's really important to say that all of us these days should be and are diagonal.
Yeah.
You know, the horizontal build-up of health systems, absolutely critical. But if that's all you focus on, you're going to let some really important diseases fly out, because you can't just bring all boats up. You know, malaria will come back in 2 years like nobody's business.
How does politics come into this? Because the mosquito doesn't say, well, this is the Congo, they've banned it here, I'll nip over to the neighbouring country. It's, I would imagine, something that is never, never going to happen unless you can get political leaders aligned on it.
So, I mean, I was talking to the ex-Minister of Health of Nigeria a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, if he had, which he does actually, because he's now running a philanthropic organisation, if he had money to invest, where would he put it? He said he would put it into the kind of mid-level management of government health and malaria campaigns and such like, because that's where actually he said there's people at the top kind of doing okay, but it's the kind of mid-level where we really need to build up capacity.
And these are in individual countries you're talking
about? In individual countries in Africa. And I thought that was very, I mean, you know, it sounded very sensible and very much based on his experience. Incidentally, he was the person that really kind of set up Nigeria to be able to almost eliminate polio. So he's a man who speaks what he knows. But our role is to keep making sure that politician after politician, leader after leader, prioritizes malaria, something that probably doesn't affect most of them, or they don't even see its effects very much, to be quite honest.
We started a bit this morning by talking about the royal wedding. And the effect, if there is going to be one, you're talking about, we're talking about the sort of number one celebrities in the land at the moment, and you use celebrity. Why do you? Do you think it's effective? Who does it grab, and how do you get one?
Wow. We're going to give him three questions in one. Never knowingly undersold.
Never knowingly undersold. And I want one.
We were really lucky that one of our founders was a wonderful guy called Simon Fuller, who you may remember was worked with the Spice Girls when they first came out, and was and still is very involved with Andy Murray and David Beckham. And so we were very lucky that Andy and David came behind the charity from the beginning. Now, what's good about that is, and what's amazing about that, is that David did a film for us in the run-up to the summit.
Saw it.
Camilla has seen it.
Yeah.
Should we let Camilla describe it? Because I think this is only fair.
So do I.
Keith and I haven't seen this film, this footage. Camilla, just tell us in your own words what you saw on this video.
Well, there are two films on YouTube. One is the film, and one is the making of the film. And the film is David Beckham in a glass box, no top. Can't remember about the trousers.
No top?
No top. Okay. Tattooed up the wazoo.
Where is the wazoo, Keith?
It's a very North American thing.
That sounds like a Canadian term to me. Okay, he's tattooed up the wazoo.
Tattooed all over his body, David.
Oh, okay.
I could describe it, but I won't. You should see. It's an image thing. Then over top of that are some words. And the first few seconds is a few mosquitoes. Bit of word. The next, many more mosquitoes. Bit of word. The next, you're thinking fast forward to the end. And a lot of mosquitoes.
We can be the generation that ends it for good.
Malaria must die. So millions can live.
Who sold that? Who sold that to Beckham?
Quite.
Was he in the box with them?
So many questions.
We'd like the answer.
We have fun here.
Do you know what? The answer, you're going to be so disappointed with this answer because I wasn't there. I mean, you know, I actually didn't go. I mean, I feel like a bit of a fool in some ways, but you know, I've got this brilliant director of comms and partnerships, and Kate did it. You know, I can't claim any credit for that at all. She was the one that talked to David's management, and she's the one that kind of brought the whole thing together. And she got Ridley Scott's people to do the film.
Yeah.
So all of your wonderful questions about how was it and everything, I'm not going to be able to tell you. What I can tell you is that it reached 930 million people. So when you talk about, you know, why did you do it? The answer is that in the build-up to a summit where you've got leaders all getting together, to be able to have something where they know that this has been seen by hundreds of millions of people, it really matters.
I just want to be a fly on the wall. I want to be a mosquito on the wall.
Mosquito on the wall.
At the point where someone says, and David, would you mind taking all your clothes off?
Yeah, but only bite me here.
Yeah, which I think is a job that Camilla would probably do very well. One theme that runs out of not just what we're talking about now, but in a sense of your career, is looking at how you can make an impact with a fairly modest infrastructure. And we've talked about this huge event that you've just successfully put on and successfully got attention towards. And you did it with a staff of 12? How on earth do you leverage that amount of power from a small team like that?
Number one is make sure that the people that you have got are outstanding. And number two, and most importantly, I think, is have the humility, and I don't want to sound Micawber-esque, but have the humility to understand that you cannot do it yourselves. And that's a fundamental thing, because that then makes you understand that you need to build up a massive coalition of partners.
It's interesting, because we've talked a lot about control on the podcast, and Camilla, one of your lines on the Oxfam scandal has been, you know, this is a big organisation that couldn't control what its foot soldiers were doing. When you've got a dozen people, you know where everybody is at any one time, and presumably you are monitoring what they're doing quite closely.
But I would imagine you don't need to know where they all are, because if you make the right choices, and this is the job, as it were, of the CEO and the chair of the organization, to put the best people in, and the people who are way smarter than you are, which means you've got to have the judgment to choose those people and the humility to choose those people, because you need to be able to say, I don't know this, I don't know that, but you do. And then you let them run. So you don't have to monitor them 24/7. It's not like play school.
And that is the beauty of staff that live the cause. Because once they live the cause, then it's, you know, like Blackpool Rock. You know, it goes right the way through them. They will go out there and they will look at the opportunities. They will read the newspaper and say, ah, I can make something of that. Because 9 times out of 10, as we know, they don't do it for the money.
Yeah, but what do you do when you fundamentally want change? Now you have to, quote, restructure. And the difficulty that you've got is that your charity staff are hugely invested, hugely inspired, and you have to get rid of people. But those people, having invested that, also feel in an odd kind of way, at least I think it's odd, that they are beneficiaries of that charity. The cry goes up, well, you can't treat me like this. Well, you are an employee. You're not a beneficiary. The beneficiaries of the charity are the people who are dying of malaria. What do you do? And I know you dealt with this before.
Tell us about your worst experience of having to make those.
I wasn't going to say it like that.
Well, I may have to do it for you.
Can I say one thing before I get onto that, which is just that I think that this is why getting upfront recruitment is so, so important, you know, to try to avoid ever putting yourself into that position. And I do really believe that, having gone through the episode that you're alluding to, which was at Friends of the Earth, I came in and within 3 or 4 months, we suddenly were facing the financial crisis. And by that, I mean the kind of the global financial crisis. Friends of the Earth had kind of overextended itself in one way or another, in response to what had been a very optimistic financial environment. And so we suddenly realised that the charity was going to go deeply, deeply into the red, and pretty quickly if we didn't take action.
And this was principally because during that financial crash, those individuals who'd been voluntarily contributing on a monthly basis to Friends of the Earth were pulling in their standing orders and thinking, I'm not sure I can afford it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Friends of the Earth, if I remember it, I think it's 80 to 90% of its income comes from just people who are giving those monthly amounts, which is a tremendous strength. I mean, and it's a real vote of confidence in that organisation. It's wonderful. But what it means is that you can actually forecast very clearly, according to the economy, what those people are going to do. And it was very clear that enough of them, because of the financial downturn, were going to start cancelling. And it wasn't like we had lots of other options for fundraising to go to.
To put it in brutal terms, you came in as the vision guy. You then became the hatchet guy quite quickly.
Yeah.
How did that feel?
It felt pretty bad. Now, I don't. Yeah, I mean, when I came in, you know, we came in, Friends of the Earth, it was just, everything was optimistic, it was exciting, we were just winning the Big Ask campaign. I take no credit for that, it had been done by all the previous folks. That was to create the first climate act in the world. I mean, it was major stuff. And then suddenly we were hit by this and had to deal with it. I mean, actually, in terms of what I found out about myself, if I'm being really honest, it is that the period of 6 to 9 months, and it was 6 to 9 months, where we had to go from realising what we had to do to actually going through the whole process. You knew what you had to do. It's a bit like this malaria summit. You haven't got that many choices, actually. Actually, the most tricky bit is always, I think, the transition and coming out of something like that, the year or two after that, when you have to start kind of trying to get people to look ahead and not be thinking about what's just happened.
What you've raised there is what happens in a number of charities, certainly smaller ones, where they don't take enough time to look at where the percentage of their income is coming from, and that some of them rely too much just on one area. The words I think that we need to be very clear on is that if charities are getting more than 50% of their funding from one source, they, boy, are they at risk. Because as soon as that starts to dry up, you know, you're at 80% from different people, but, you know, as a risk profile, that's very much the same. And I guess from that, did you recover from those people, and how did you do that?
Well, we took a very clear decision to invest in our fundraising, which actually made the cuts more challenging, of course, because if you're investing in your fundraising, you're having to take more money into that. But we said, you know, we cannot go on just slip sliding down the slope. We've got to really make a concerted effort to get out of this. So financially, within a couple of years, we were back in a really good place. I'm not going to say that the organisation was in a good place, though. I mean, when you have to put every single person in that organisation, apart from myself and the boss, at risk of redundancy, that's not something that, you know, that's really hard for people to go through.
How did you keep funders on board while going through this, what must have been a horrendous upheaval for everybody, and yet not make them run in the opposite direction?
I'll be honest, I found that challenging because we had those 100,000 people that are giving regular gifts. And actually, you can't quite ring every single one of them and reassure them or whatever. So what we tried to do was to be fairly open about what was happening with all of our supporters, because Friends of the Earth also relies on its volunteer groups all over the country as well. Yeah. Incredibly important. And I think one of the great challenges for a chief exec is sounding certain about expected future outcomes when actually you're in a really difficult and uncertain place. And to me, when I think about what is really important about a director, not just a chief exec, or any kind of leader, that to me is one of the most important parts of it. Obviously, you've got to be realistic, but to be able to project a kind of sense of the future when you're in a really dark place, that's tough.
I just think that is so,
so important.
That bit about giving them the vision of what it's going to look like when it's fixed, okay? Knowing inside you, we've got a long way to go.
This is quite interesting because I know that in another organisation you ran, Hope and Homes for Children, you had to do quite a spectacular turn, and you were 27 years old at the time, and you had to do something quite dramatic. Tell me what it was.
I came into an organisation which it was three people at that time, a former British Army commander and his wife, two amazing people, and we were building orphanages. So they'd come across an orphanage in Sarajevo, and he'd given up the army to rebuild it during the siege. It was an extraordinary story. And I realised within about 3 or 4 months of joining that, I began to realise that building orphanages was not the right thing to be doing for children who were orphaned, abandoned, vulnerable, and that actually what we should actually be doing was closing down orphanages and enabling children to grow up in families. Simple as that. And it was quite a challenge when you're 27 and you've given up being a lawyer and you've joined a charity and you find that what you are thinking is directly contrary to what your boss is thinking.
You wrote a letter.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to explain on it. I mean, it was a very long letter, but it was about 14 or 15 pages, I think. Goodness knows how he read it. But I knew how passionate Mark was, and he's a phenomenal...
Should we just name check him Mark?
Mark Cook, yeah. Mark Cook. Yeah, Colonel Mark Cook. And I was worried, though, nervous, age 27, as to when to give him the letter, so I gave it to him almost literally as he was boarding a flight to Bosnia, because I thought, well, that'll give him 5 days to think about it.
Very good.
And
Mark
was lovely. He said that was the most choppy, up and down flight he's ever had in his life. But he came back, and it's classic Mark, really, that he was so open to thinking about it. I mean, he found it very difficult, but he was so open to talking about it, and that's one of the great things, you know, if you get a charity founder who's not only passionate but open like that, then you're very lucky.
I think the statistic you'd unearthed is that 80% of those children in those orphanages did have family and quite close family outside and probably in quite a reasonable vicinity, but those families didn't necessarily have the resources to cope with those children. Is that a fair assessment of it?
That's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, and, you know, there are still millions of children in these huge kind of institutions, warehouses, whatever you want to call them, all over the world. And, you know, some of them are, quote, run well, and some of them are run not so well. But, you know, no child should ever really grow up in a very big building without people that they can relate to as being family or a substitute family.
Did you fundamentally change your aims? So you were there to build orphanages. Now you're there to close orphanages. Did that change your aims? And if so, what did the Charity Commission say?
Funnily enough, it doesn't change your aims, because whatever you're trying to do, you're trying to provide care and love and a home for children. So actually, whichever one you do, you're still doing that. You're just doing it in a completely different way. So, yes, I mean, it was a change of how we go about meeting those aims. But it wasn't actually a change of what the ultimate purpose was, which was to ensure that children that didn't have families or had very weak families should have that kind of family care. And I'm really proud that the organisation is now at the forefront of trying to end institutional care for children worldwide. So
I think that's a great success, and well done, you know, to actually bite that bullet. And as David was saying, you know, at that young age, when you go into that lion's den of, this could be my P45, you know, coming into that. And that does take a brave chief exec at times to do it, to stand up and say, stop. I'd like to pick up on some other things if I just can, though, because, and I'm with you on the tips that I've got down on my bit of paper here that you've said. It's about having the right people on board, and we've said that. But the two other things is, take time to look after yourself. What do you do to take time to look after yourself then?
I'm going to say that I've had times in my career when I felt pretty dark about things. There were times at Friends of the Earth, and it wasn't just driven by what we had to do. It was just, you know, things I was going through. We had children who were just being born and what have you. And, you know, life was, yeah, I mean, I felt fairly dark about stuff at that time. I think that one of the things that has helped me to get out of that was that I found a mentor who has, you know, she's done it out of the goodness of her heart, and she was a board member at Friends of the Earth. She left and has remained my mentor, and I see her every 2 or 3 months. And if I've got 4 or 5 of my biggest problems, I just go and talk them through with her. And it's like those 2 hours, I come out the other side just feeling completely refreshed and renewed. And I really believe that I try to get other people that are working with me to have something similar. It doesn't have to be the same, because everybody has different things, but some way of being able to get out of this really intense kind of place and be able to just reflect and you know, think about stuff.
From a lot of chief execs, they still believe that once you get there, all the burden's on you, and every monkey's on your back, you know, every time someone gives you a problem. And just having a critical friend with you that you can trust in an open, honest way is a good message for any chief exec or MD out there.
The stories work fine, don't they? A route to the Rotary Club dinners, to the presentations at your annual general meetings or whatever. How do you tell that story to that high net worth individual who's just walked into the room at the conference you've organised, and you see him or her and your jaw drops and you realise you've got a very small window of opportunity to convince that person that your charity is a worthy beneficiary of their wealth?
You give them the vision, you tell them how you're going to do it, and you explain what they can do to help you do it in a very simple way. So if, for malaria, it would be that
come on, let's role play. Keith is your high net worth individual over there.
I've got a bit of money here. Yeah.
He's got a very flash watch on today, so that's a good starting point. So Keith is your high net worth individual. Give him the shtick.
Malaria affects 200 million people every year, keeping them out of work and out of education. But most importantly, it kills about 400,000 children under five every year, and yet treatment costs less than £1. Not only that, but we could actually end what is the biggest disease in human history within our generation. Now, that is a legacy that I think beats all legacies. And if you support us, then your pound could not be going any further, because this tiny organisation has just managed to get 53 leaders to sign up to halving malaria. It's just managed to get $4 billion. So please, please invest in us. And by the way, everybody, that's a genuine, genuine request.
Here comes the cash. There is a tear in Keith Davis's right eye. He's put a pound coin on the table. You've bought that high net worth individual. Thank you very much. That's like a masterclass. James Whiting, Chief Exec of Malaria No More UK. Many thanks. Health Bells. We were all rather impressed with that guy, weren't we?
I was very impressed. With all of the experiences, still grounded.
Yeah.
Which, for me, is the important bit about being a chief exec of a charity.
The lack of ego, isn't
Absolutely.
It? I mean, that's something which we come back to time and time again. Observing the team you're working with, spotting the talent within that team, taking your own ego out of it and allowing everybody to operate and work in their own space and environment.
When you hear from somebody like that who says and appears to be slightly nervous, it's incredibly endearing. Mm-hmm. It's also, in an odd way, confidence building, because you think if somebody is that passionate about what they're doing, if you want to do that well, there has to be an element of nervousness.
Yeah, and it was thoughtful. You know, he didn't come in on any bravado. You know, it was thoughtful. He was, I thought, gentle almost at times, you know, about that. And yet you know him better than we do.
But it's not about banging the table, is it?
No.
That's the other thing.
Banging
the table doesn't always work.
No. But that's a judgment call, isn't it? You know, you've got to get the attention to start
Well, it's
with.
A shock tactic. Banging the table is an absolute, as you just did with banging over the cups. It's a shock tactic. It wakes us up, but doesn't get us anywhere.
No.
So now we're
no.
awake, and what are we going to do next?
No.
And I think that thoughtful interaction, listening, speaking, evolving, creating, that's what's so fruitful.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so much fun and so interesting.
But look, the other thing he does, that point he said, it's a lonely, lonely, dark place at
it
times,
is,
the chief exec. That's really interesting, isn't it? I know we're all very moved by that.
Yeah, and it's true, you know, and that's why what I hope we're doing within these discussions is sharing that it's okay to be in a dark place at times, but we want to help give you places and ideas of where you can get out of it and get that support.
So this has been Good Charity, Bad Charity. You can check out our growing, growing back catalogue. Yeah. Read, mark, learn, inwardly digest, as my old history teacher, Mr. Ram, used to say. Rate and review us on iTunes, Apple Music, whichever is your podcast platform of choice. Good Charity, Bad Charity is produced by the man next door, Dan Hardoon. It's recorded here at Whistledown Studios, the boutique studio hire of choice for podcasters of all shapes and sizes. I just have one point to note, which is that James Whiting has left the studio. He's left your pound coin on the table. He didn't even take your money, Keith.
He's obviously loaded.
What's all that about?
Well, you know, when you're sat with $4 billion, sorry.
And all those celebs.
Till next time.
I've been Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
I've been David Preston. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity.